Good evening, one and oh, I know it's December already. I moved it took the full 21 days to Christmas, and finally, or I sent all my cards to England today, so I've done that, and I've sort of sorted out sort of Christmas. Sort of. Let's face it, we've only just had Thanksgiving here in America, and that's all turkey, and of course, in England, Christmas is turkey, so. And I like turkey, so we're going to have turkey for Christmas as well. I don't care. Anyway, I am here, and so is my guest. Now, talking about England, my guest is actually in England at the moment, so it's just gone midnight there. So I'm ever so glad he stayed up for us. He is actually in a place pretty close to where I used to live before I came over to America. We've just been talking about that. But he was born in London, educated in France and Oxford University. Now there's a mixture for you, hey? But he has done so much. You know, you get these things, and we have these stories about these adventurers that did this, you know, been there, done it, got the t-shirt, everything like that. Well, my guest has done a lot of that. I'm going to wait till he comes on the show before just discussing some of the things he's done. But I better introduce him, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only George Armand. Hi, George. How you doing?
Pretty good, thank you, Barry. Good shape.
It's good to have you on the show, and as I said, yeah, at the start there, sort of looking at the stuff you've done, it's enough. You know, they say truth is stranger than fiction, and in your case, it is with a lot of things. You've ridden horseback for 1,500 miles across Europe. I mean, that's how long was that Hidalgo? That was a fraction, couple of hundred, wasn't it? That film, 1,500 miles you did. You've worked at the Calgary Stampede on a champion chuck wagon driver. You sailed two oceans on a square rig ship. You've taken the Flying Scotsman, which I can remember going and to Oakley Park Station there and standing on the bridge to watch the Flying Scotsman go by. The thing is, you didn't go on the Flying Scotsman in England. You did it Boston to Houston. So Tony knows how it got there. And you know, you've done so much with your stuff, and now, finally, I guess after all these adventuring, you've brought us a fantastic, based on true, adventure type book with even higher than Everest. Was it the fact you just got tired doing all the stuff? You thought you better sit down and write about it, George?
Well, not entirely. The thing was that I actually met Mr. Tenzing Norgay,
Okay, yeah.
and this was some time ago, and well, actually about 1960, I should think. And he was the first man in the world ever to get to the top and survive. And I was always sort of hooked on Everest from that point of view. And then I learned about the pilots who flew there 20 years before he got there, and they put together a survey of the Himalayas from their open cockpit biplanes. And I was learning to fly at the time, and so I was kind of half hooked there straight away.
Right.
But I wasn't going to go up there myself at 35,000 feet.
I mean, you say 35,000 because the Himalayas is actually still growing. It's a very young mountain range, so it's still actually
Correct.
going,
Yep.
yeah, it's going up a bit. But I mean, this was in the 30s, 1930s, wasn't it? Which, of course, when they used to have all the plane races and everything like that. And wasn't it down to some heiress or something like that? Didn't she sort
Well,
of put the idea or something?
no, she was an amazing woman. She was a Cockney dancer originally when she
Wow.
started life. And she was an ambitious lady, I think, because in the end she had four husbands and lived on a huge, beautiful yacht that was once Joseph Pulitzer's,
Okay, yeah.
which a local man to you there.
Yeah.
And she got the yacht and sailed around Britain with it, with a big sign on it cursing the Labour government at the time.
I think I can vaguely remember seeing a picture of that. If actually, I going back, but somewhere along the lines, I've come across that. But yeah. she was some woman, as you say. And what gave her this idea of, you know?
Well, she'd already sponsored the RAF doing the Schneider trophies around. And then along came this young, he was the Duke of Hamilton, actually. Mm-hmm. The young Duke being Marquis Clydesdale at the time. And he managed to persuade her to part with a tidy sum, almost $1.5 million by today's money. And wow. She put up the money for the flight. Nobody else in England could have it. Nobody had a chance.
Right.
So she was the only person who rose to it. Without her, it would never have happened. So they sent the five aeroplanes out to India. Two of them were specially adapted for the flight.
Uh-huh.
From Westlands down in Somerset.
Right.
And I met the test pilot for Westlands.
Oh.
And he was an amazing man. He'd flown 460 types of aircraft.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And he could remember every rivet in the particular Everest biplane. He tested it along the coast here, not far from where you used to live, Hailsham.
Uh-huh.
And they blew it up. The engine blew up at some sort of 35,000 feet. And he turned it round and glided all the way back to Hamble on the Isle of Wight area.
Oh,
down
wow,
there.
That's a big glide.
Well, when he landed, he jumped out and he said, change the oil filter or get a new oil pump and you'll be all right. You'll get it over the mountain.
Because, I mean, the oxygen thing must have been
a big thing.
Yeah.
Well, this was actually how it opened the way to our modern travel that we have now.
Right.
Because without this sort of testing, none of it would have happened so quickly. They had special suits with, you know, like spider sort of suits with electric wires running through everything. And these quite often they got burnt once or twice by the heated wires, which wasn't much fun. Then they had oxygen sort of ran out occasionally, and they had one of them actually broke the oxygen pipe, and they had to get him out of there in a hurry.
Oh, crikey.
So it wasn't all plain sailing. It was quite sort of hairy stuff.
I bet. Now, I can vaguely, and I must have seen it or at a Saturday cinemas or on the early days of television when you used to have these sort of documentaries, that there was a short film about this. Was it
you're right.
Flying over Everest, Wings over Everest.
There was a film called Wings over Everest.
Okay, right.
And that was the one that won an Oscar, believe it
oh,
or not.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. It was the same film crew who made it, who did the original 39 Steps for John Buchan.
Okay, yep.
And John Buchan was very much behind the Everest Project because he was, as you may know, he was going to become governor of Canada eventually.
That's and right.
He loved mountaineering, but he wasn't going to take on the Himalayas.
Right.
So he got behind the Everest Project and made a lot of things happen.
Right.
It wasn't just pilots. It was diplomats. It was engineers.
Sorts. Yeah. Yeah,
and that's what I've tried to put into the book, sort of condense them. I admit it's somewhat dramatized, but the whole book follows very accurately the true story.
I know you said that it was meeting, is it Tenzing? Not Hillary, was it Tenzing you met? That sort of,
yes, and Lord Hunt, who was the leader of the expedition.
Right, because wasn't it recently that they found Irving?
They found Mallory's body a few years ago. I think it was a National Geographic team.
Yeah,
did somebody
find a foot or something
like
that recently?
You're right. Only in the last few months. Yes.
Yeah.
And it belonged to Mr. Irving. Sadly, they couldn't find the body.
So they don't know whether he got up there and came back or it was going up. So there's no proof that he actually got there still. Right.
Well, I think proof, they have a photo, not a photo, but they was last seen in 1924, just before the, before they got to the top of the mountain. They were seen by people lower down, by Noel O'Dell,
okay,
who's one of the climbers. And then they slipped off, presumably, in the fog or in the cloud.
Right.
And I think they must have fell about probably a mile and a half to, 4,000, 5,000 feet.
Oh, crikey. Yeah.
And I don't think they had much luck after that. So,
was it, yeah.
But the question still remains, did he get to the top or not? And the answer is, if they find the cameras that they had with them, they might have the answer then. So people are still looking for the cameras.
They're finding stuff all the time, aren't they? I mean, this is the thing. I mean, things change, bits melt, bits fall off.
Well, I think the climate's making it easier to find these things.
Right.
Because the glaciers are melting quicker than they should do.
And also, didn't they shut it down a while ago or a few years back for like a few months to clean up the summit or something?
Yeah, I think you're right. There was a lot, and there still is a lot of debris, but they are trying to clear it up, obviously, for good reasons.
Now, go ahead, after you.
No, well, I mean, I'm actually hoping to... I'm building a new version of the aeroplane that made the flight.
Oh, cool.
We've got that being built up here in England.
Okay.
It could take a year or two to get finished because funding's not that strong at the minute.
No, like everything. But
on the other hand, if we go up there, we won't be leaving any rubbish around.
Right. Okay. In your book, Even Higher Than Everest, is this a book like a story based on the true story, or is it actually just a fact thing?
No, it's definitely not a fact thing, but it is all based on fact.
Okay.
What I've done is I've dramatised some of the
conversations.
That's
the word I was looking for, dramatised. Right, yeah.
Because I know also all the characters are there that were in there are more or less exactly the ones that went on the trip. And the aeroplane elements are 100% true. I mean, they found crocodiles in their swimming pool. They had snakes under the bed. They had all sorts of horrible things happen to them in India.
Oh, crikey.
And those are all true. No, I didn't invent it.
This is what I say. I mean, I say this to people, the truth is stranger than fiction so many times. I mean, but you say some of this stuff and people won't believe you. But yeah, that happened.
So I've tried to make it entertaining because originally the book, the original stuff, it was quite factual.
Yeah.
It was rather like an RAF reporting sort of, type thing.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this could do with a little more lightheartedness to sort of jazz it up a bit. But anyway, Lady Houston, Lucy Houston, didn't need any. I mean, she was a monster and a terror. I mean, she got them all going.
Right.
And then, of course, I'll tell you one thing that would amuse you.
Uh-huh.
When they made two flights over Everest, the first one, the cameras didn't work. They had no record.
Oh, no!
So the next day, they took up the aeroplanes to Kanchenjunga, which is another big monster mountain just down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And they tested them there. But on the way back, they ran out of petrol and crash-landed twice on the same flight.
Oh, no.
And when they heard of this in London, they were forbidden to go flying again. They said, well, you've lost your photographs and you've nearly lost the aeroplanes. So we at Lloyd's Insurance, and we the sponsor, and we the committee, forbid any more flying. So then the film people came along and they said, well, we can help you out of this problem. We need lots of footage for our film. So keep flying at low altitude. And where you go after you've gone over the horizon is up to you. And so the last... So off they went again, and they got all the photos they wanted and more, really. And but they were flying without insurance, without the RAF's permission, and without anybody's. So if anything had happened, it would have been quite serious, perhaps.
How many actually ended up flying over Everest? I mean, you said there was five planes. How many actually made it over and did some pictures?
No, there were three small aircraft and moths, de Havillands, flew out all the way. That was an incredible trip on its own. 1 month it took them to fly all the way around North Africa, through Egypt, across the deserts of Saudi Arabia and all of that area. And finally they got to India, where they picked up two of the two big aeroplanes, which had been specially designed and fitted out for this flight. And then, so there were four men, basically, in two machines. And in each machine, they had a camera, a movie camera.
Uh-huh.
And they had special survey cameras for doing the topography of the ground below them. So the two pilots were extremely good pilots, obviously. It was quite hairy up there. I mean,
one of them
thought it was like flying over an ammunition dump, flying up, blowing up.
Everything's going to blow up, yeah.
Yeah. There was an open cockpit, remember?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, that wasn't exactly a Sopwith Camel, but it wasn't far off.
Oh, and it was a very strong Sopwith Camel. But they had a lot of kind of other adventures on the way with various Maharajas, and a baby elephant charged them one day while they were playing tennis and nearly flattened a lot of them.
Was it more dangerous flying or being on the ground?
Well, you were right. Actually, that point is made, I think, in the book, actually.
Yeah. Oh, that's nothing. Flying over Everest, nothing. You should see what we do when we play tennis.
Well, I was in Hollywood a few years ago, and I met some film gentleman, I forget his name, and he told me, he said, well, what's so special about flying over? I fly to New York every week, he said, and, you know, I go over the Rockies. Huh? And I said, yes, but the Rockies are half the height, I said.
Yeah.
The Himalayas are exactly double the height of the Rockies. And he then understood. Then he said to me, do you think it's got snow on the top? And I said,
No, don't, because my opinion of Americans and their knowledge of geography and history and stuff is zero. So I
Well, no, they are very good fellas, but I don't think the West Coast fellas quite understand. I'm sure the New Yorkers are actually much more attuned to the general idea of adventure and exploration.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things I like about, well, I really love about doing this show, and I've been doing this for about 13, 14 years now, I think, is that I learn stuff all the time. You know, I learn about, I don't know, you know, like historical things and things about geographical things. And like, yeah, this now with the flight and stuff like that, you never stop learning, and there's always new discoveries. It seems to be, obviously, with the sort of, the sort of space cameras and stuff we now have. I mean, stuff's being discovered all the time, you know, that's hidden this, and, you know, this has been taking a picture, and you can see this old town in the desert and all this. You know, it's great.
In a way, this was almost like the first space flight. And the other thing that you might like to remember is that Lucy Houston, the heiress, after she'd finished with this, she pumped a huge amount of money into the Spitfire development program.
Right.
And so she was regarded as one of the sort of saviors of the Battle of Britain.
Yeah, she was in the who was it built? Was it Barnes Wallis? That was the bouncing bomb?
Barnes Wallis did the dam bust.
Yeah, who did the Spitfire? What's the person's name?
Well, I can't remember the design.
But the film about him when he's there designing the Spitfire and the Hurricane and that, she's in it. I'm sure that's most likely where I remember the name from. Yeah.
She put the money up for the engines.
Yeah,
mainly.
yeah,
She could see Hitler coming, you see, and nobody else in Britain could. Not many did.
Yeah.
And so she was very worried about that.
And of course, you mentioned earlier on the Schneider Trophy. Again, the film about that, because that's for that's a speed thing, but it's for water amphibious boats.
I think they went on a triangular racetrack around the Isle of Wight area, around the Solent.
Yep.
And there were Italians and French and all sorts came in.
Yeah.
And the Brits particularly wanted to get up to the top of Everest before any of the other nationalities. Well, they did. They made it by air, and they made it by the New Zealanders that got there first.
Yeah, well, that's close enough. what's the response been since you brought this book out?
Well, the response is sort of slow and steady, I think is the word. It's going, those who have read it say that they've enjoyed it immensely. I enjoy writing. I've got several other books on the go now, just to keep me busy. But I think basically it's going quite well. And my friend Mr. Barrett in Los Angeles, he's very, very helpful. And you obviously know him.
Yeah. So. One thing, you said you've got other books on the go. I read you are writing a book about Calico Jack.
Yes, now there's a character too.
Yeah.
Mine is a bit more fiction this time. I brought it up to date. These are relatives of his.
Because
he was hung by the neck down in Jamaica.
Right.
And his two ladies who he lived with, they got pregnant and were spared the meat.
That's what I was going to tell you, because it was in my history magazine a couple of months ago that, was it Bonnie and I can't remember the name of the other one.
Mary, Bonnie and Annie.
Annie, right. Yeah. They were found guilty along with him and meant to be hung. But by the time they went to be hung, they were both found to be pregnant.
Yes, I wonder how that happened.
Yeah, exactly. But then one of them disappeared. I think one died and the other one disappeared.
You're absolutely right about that. You know a lot about it. So what I've done is to bring it up to date, and they've all kind of been brought back together in the islands where they did all their... It's more of a pirate story, really, than a sort of modern crime story.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I tell you what, when that comes out, I want you back on the show, because I'd love to talk to you about that, because I like the sort of... the fact that you've been on a Square Rigger and stuff like that. I was just listening to an audiobook... Alexander Kent book, one of the Belitho series, just before I came on the show. So I love all that sort of stuff.
I'll just give you another comment. You know the famous Cutty Sark.
Yes, indeed. So I have been on it numerous times. I have run round it. Yep.
Well, one of the last times I was in New York with the Flying Scotsman train. The Cutty Sark were one of the sponsors.
Really?
Up in one of the skyscrapers you've got there, I don't know, about 50 stories up. And I said to the marketing director of Cutty Sark, what is the clue to your success? And he said, I put an ad, an advertisement on every taxi down there in the streets down there.
Well,
and that
I know.
Was the every taxi cab, every cab had a Cutty Sark sign on it.
Oh dear. And you could have given away, was it Cutty Sark whiskey? I can remember that. You'd given away a free bottle of Cutty Sark whiskey to everybody who comes on board or something. But I love all that. What other books are you looking at the moment then, working on?
Well, I've done one, well, it's kind of you to say, I've done one on Mike's rather strange life, which I've finished. I was sort of thinking I'd finish that a bit later on, but I've already finished it this winter. And another one is slightly more sci-fi, which I'm quite intrigued by the sci-fi world, and that I'll tell you about another time.
Yeah. Oh, this is fascinating. It looks like I've got several shows booked up for you.
I better come over there.
But you're right.
I'm very fond of this. I'm very fond of the States. I
know that. Well, I'd swap with you tomorrow if I could. I really would. But I, time's getting on. So what I'm going to do now, anyway, is hand the show over to you, George, and have you tell everybody where they can find more about you and your book, of course. So over to you.
Right. Well, it'd be a great pleasure to say simply it's with Jeff Bezos at Amazon. That's what it is. Amazon, look on Amazon and you'll find it there under Even Higher Than Everest. And as far as I know, it's mainly printed in Britain, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, I think so.
I think they're printing it maybe in America too, if it needs to be.
Yeah.
And I hope everybody enjoys reading it.
I tell you what, I have thoroughly enjoyed this show. I was looking forward to it, and especially once I'd sort of read a bit more about you and the book and stuff like that. I've got to speak to this gentleman. So when Charlie sort of said about it, I said, book him, please.
Thank you, Charlie. Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed talking to you, my friend.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on this show. It's been really great chatting to you.
I think we'll meet again one day.
I'm sure we will. Well, there you go. What about that? What a great show. My guest, George Almond. Almond, A-L-M-O-N-D, George, A-L-M-O-N-D, and we've been talking about his book, Even Higher Than Everest. Wonderful, based on true story about these people and the sort of contest, if you like, to see them fly above and take pictures down onto the top of Everest. Just think about that. Just think about it, the 30s. You know, when they did this, open cockpit planes, just amazing when you think what these people did and how they did. And as he said, they risked their lives not only in the planes, but on the ground from the sound of it as well. Absolutely terrific. Well, that's it for this week. I'll be back on Sunday with my two music stations, programs rather. First of all, from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern, we have Those for the Days, music from the 20th century, and being December, I can now play Christmas stuff. So that's that. And then after that, of course, between 6 and 7 p.m., the Swinging 60s, music from the 60s. Well, that's it. I'll be back next week with two more guests on Tuesday and Wednesday on A Book and a Chat. But until then, as always, I have one thing left to say.